I'm Donna.
And I'm Carrie.
And we are Paranormal Chicks.
Episode 319. Y'all, we just barely made it to record this episode. Your girl over there, your bestie, your BFF, your Donna, little Donna, Donna Lisa, your girl was like, hey, let's do dinner quick so that we can like record and go to bed because she's tired. Cut to me cooking. It's almost done. Me. We're eating. That's her cue to come over because we're eating. So by the time she gets here, we'll be done. Crickets for 30 more minutes. So cut to almost 17 missed calls and a FaceTime. And Colby and I are halfway on our way to her house when Cinderella wakes the fuck up.
Well, it would be Sleeping Beauty.
You get the point.
And yeah, I woke up and my stomach hurts because I woke up so hard, like fast. And I was like, I'm late for work. And Colby said, well, you were. But oh my gosh.
That's the worst feeling in the world when you like accidentally fall asleep and then you wake up and think it's like the next day.
Yes. And I had my phone on silent and I never had my phone on silent because I don't hear it. And I had it from work and it was just a mess. So, you know, best laid plans, y'all.
Right.
Best laid plans. But I needed to put my feet up because I hadn't been able to like really take a break today. It was just like a lot of crap at work. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to be responsible and I'm going to put my feet up, eat at home and just like chill for a minute. And that did not go well.
Back when you had your schedule where you didn't get off work until like 8 p.m. and we wouldn't be able to start recording until like 8:30. If we cooked at home, I legitimately would take a nap in between.
Yeah.
Because 8:30 p.m. is bedtime. So to start recording then, woo!
Yeah.
I would be like, I'm going to rest my eyes. And Colby's like, no, you're not. And I was like, speaking of, I took a nap on Saturday because we had our big work party on Friday. And so, you know, stayed up late, drinking, doing all the things. And so on Saturday when we got home, I fell smooth asleep, like didn't even mean to, much like you, passed out. And Colby kept waking me up and going, go to the bed, because he wanted me to get on my CPAP because it was so bad. He was like, my God, you need a CPAP so bad. And I was like, think about at the beginning of our relationship, neither one of us had a CPAP.
Right.
How did we sleep?
Oh, my God.
Like, I woke up and my throat was hurting from snoring, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, dang, how did we even function before?
So we were all on Zoom and it was like our support team was on Zoom on 420 because it was like a big day. So at the beginning, like we're just trying to like pump ourselves up and all of that. Well, one of my coworkers had said something about, oh, he had like splinters in his hand. And we were like, are you a lumberjack when you're asleep? Like, what are you doing? You know? And I was like, he's cutting down logs. I'm sawing them.
Right.
You know, and so we started talking about snoring. And he said that he had went on a bachelor's trip. And one of the friends was like, hey, I don't care who I room with. I just don't want someone who snores. And so he was like, oh, I got you. Like, well, room. It's fine. And the friend was like, what the fuck? You snored so fucking bad. And the guy is engaged. And he was like, my fiance never has told me that I snore. Like, I had no idea. I was like, that's hilarious. You know, that friend was like, the fuck?
Yes. Also, how has that never come up that you snore?
Yeah, I'm like, okay, you cannot be that bad. Like, that friend must have been real sensitive.
Correct.
Because no one had to tell me I snore. Because, like you said,
you wake yourself
you'll
up
wake
snoring.
Yourself up.
Yes.
Like, your throat kind of hurt. So, again, I mean, it was a funny story, but I'm like, that guy had to be super sensitive.
Yes.
Because, and there's no way that we could ever date because he,
Donna sounds like a literal freight train. Like, the walls are shaking, everything. But what was so funny, though, when I was taking my unexpected nap, too, was that, again, Colby kept being like, go lay down, go lay down. And so one time he said my name. And apparently, I woke up and said, what? I didn't do anything.
Guilty mind over there.
Well, while we're talking about what's on our mind, let's talk about Patreoners. Those segues, man. So thank you so much, Stacy P. from Mississippi.
Leonella C. from Arizona.
Brenda L. from Texas.
And Private from West Virginia. Now, your name said Private, so we want to, you know, respect your privacy. But if you're like, oh, I didn't mean that, let us know and we'll shout you out.
But I deem you Sophia. If you want an episode shout out, a thank you letter with stickers, and an extra episode a week, head on over to patreon.com/theapcpodcast. Y'all know my love of vanilla soft serve ice cream and sprinkles. And we talked about this a little bit on the last episode, right?
Yeah.
The work party that I have is at a casino. So Colby and I decided we were going to try the breakfast buffet again. Because last time wasn't that wonderful. So we're like, okay, let's give it a go. Cut to, it still wasn't that great. But they had their soft serve ice cream ready. And they had sprinkles. And they had M&Ms. And they had chocolate chips. And I was like, well, I'm in fucking heaven.
Worth the $30.
Legitimately $30
a piece. Oh my God.
I think it was 26 or 28. Whew. I go and I make my bowl of ice cream. And when I sat down, Colby's eyes got about as big as my bowl of ice cream. And it was like, holy fuck. Because I did not get the ice cream bowl. Never get that.
Never.
Uh-uh. That's child's play. I didn't get the salad bowl.
Oh, you didn't get the salad bowl either.
I got the pho bowl.
Oh, shit.
It was the biggest fucking bowl. And I didn't fill it all the way up. But let me just say, it sounded like I was eating chips. I had so many sprinkles and chocolate chips.
That's the best.
Oh, it was so good. I'm like, man, I should have just eaten just this, like three bowls of this.
Oh, my stomach would have been, oh.
Oh, it was. Oh, it was. Because the way home from the coast for us, where the casinos are, it's a bunch of like antiquing. So we went to probably three or four different antique stores on the way home. It was fun, but not for my stomach.
Yeah. And no wonder you fell asleep when you got home. You crashed from that sugar.
For real.
Okay. So my story, it's a little all over the place this time. So
are you right now.
So true. But if I say, who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters.
Okay. So that's what I'm talking about today.
Ghostbusters?
Well, yeah, but the guy behind Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Who I know more from My Girl.
Dan Aykroyd?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to know what's so funny? Literally, when I came home from work today, The Great Outdoors was playing. Colby and I watched the end of The Great Outdoors. Like while we were cooking and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that movie gives me so much anxiety. And I said that, and he goes, "Is there a movie that doesn't give you anxiety?"
That's very true.
That was my exact response. But he's like, "Why does this movie give you anxiety?" I'm like, "Because he's like lying about his money, and the kids get lost, and all the things, and it just gives me anxiety." So that's pretty funny that you're talking about him when we literally—I mean, that movie's from like 1988.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to think about what I wanted to do, and my coworkers had some solid ideas. I was like, yeah. But then I watched, again,
Unsolved Mysteries?
No, Southern Charm.
Oh,
no, Lord. Not Southern Charm. Sorry. No, not that, but Summer House.
Ah.
And they had an out-of-this-world party, because, you know, they have their theme parties in the Hamptons, and it was alien-themed. And Kyle, one of the like main stars, he dressed up as Coneheads or whatever. And I was like, wait, I've been kind of wanting to do this story, but there wasn't a ton on it. And then with that, I was like, I've got to do it. So if you didn't know, Dan Aykroyd really wrote Ghostbusters based off of little events in his life.
What?
I mean, he didn't have a Stay Puft in his life or whatever it's called, but yeah.
Not me thinking you were talking about a vape for a second.
A vape?
Yeah, Stay Puft.
Oh.
Todd was like, a vape? What's a vape?
I am knowing all the stuff now. Well, my coworker Callie, shout out to her, because every time someone has something or there's a new product, she's like, let me show my friend Donna. And she'll show me like exactly how like the vape pen works and like the concentrate that goes on it and all of that. And I'm like, oh my gosh, a whole new world.
Hashtag work for a cannabis company.
But okay, before we get into all of that, we're going to talk a little bit about the Aykroyd family. Because apparently being spooky and spiritual runs in his family because he is fourth generation weirdo. And I mean that in the best term of endearment. It started with Dan's great-grandfather. His name is Samuel Aykroyd, and he was at first a teacher. But then later in his life, he went into dentistry.
That's a change.
Right. And now this is back like in the early 1900s. So apparently like you didn't have to do a whole lot to be a dentist, I guess. You know what I mean? Like he didn't have to do like 8 years of school or any of that. Just picture it. You get dental work done, but there's no topical numbing creams or anything like that. You just raw dog it and you pass out from the pain. So around this time, Samuel had heard about other dentists and other medical professionals using hypnosis to get their patients calm and stuff. So he decided to start trying that. And from there, he really started getting into spiritualism more heavily. He ended up meeting this man, Walter Ashurst, who was a sensitive. So in 1921, Walter started hosting seances at Samuel's house, and so much so that he ended up moving in for like 12 years with Samuel and his wife so he could host these weekly seances that were like a spectacle at their house. And now remember, Samuel is of like a scientific mind as well. Like he's very like process oriented and he wants to document things. So he did keep a journal of the seances. So there's tons of entries about what had happened. Apparently, various people would come through during the seances and they would take over Walter. And when they would come through, Walter would, you know, take on their accent, start speaking the language they spoke. Like there was this Irish guy named Mike Whalen, and then a member of the Chinese Ming Dynasty named Li Long. And he was like a frequent flyer, and Samuel was so impressed because Walter did not know how to speak Chinese, but he spoke fluent Mandarin when Li Long was present. There were also other spirits that would come through, such as an Egyptian prince named Blue Light and some Native Americans. And like I said, this happened for like over a decade. Samuel ended up passing away in 1933, but the curiosity did not end with him because Maurice, his son, took up the torch. Maurice had really set his sights on inventing a device that would capture ghost voices. So, I mean, I feel like it was a spirit box, but like an early idea of a spirit box. And he had some help from Peter, who is his son and Dan's father. But ultimately, Maurice said that he was told by the spirits, like, you're not going to be successful, so, like, stop trying, dude. You're not going to capture our voices. And so they ended up abandoning that idea. But I think it was really in hopes of not just capturing, like, a ghost voice, but Samuel's voice. And it was just to reunite with Maurice's father. So again, like, spiritualism and mysticism and all of that have ran in Dan's family for a while, but there are two places that really helped inspire Ghostbusters. It's Samuel's farmhouse and also a house that Dan lived in California. Now, for the farmhouse, that's where Dan lives now. But also, when he was growing up, he had lots of experiences that were unexplainable. When he was just born, he said that his mother had an experience one night where she was nursing him and she had like closed her eyes because it's like early in the fucking morning and just like, you know, kind of rocking him, letting him nurse. But when she opened them, she saw a couple standing at the end of the bed. So she yelled for Dan's dad. And when she did, the couple vanished. She described them to him and he was like, hold on, and got the family album out. And she was like, yes. And it was Samuel and his wife. It was like they had come to see baby Dan and welcome him into the family. So what I'm picturing is that they were younger than what she had remembered and like really seen in pictures before. And then Dan also said that there was a time that he felt like he had been struck by lightning. And it was like he had been obviously zapped, but there wasn't bad weather or anything. It was just like so much energy.
Okay. Well, funny that you say that too, because I was going to say that my dad always loved the great outdoors because the character.
Oh my God.
With the lightning strikes was his favorite.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Now I remember you saying that.
And it's like, it really is like a hilarious character. And so like, I'm wondering if that had anything to do with this.
Fuck, I don't know.
Because did he participate in writing The Great Outdoors?
I don't know. And something else I don't know is what he means by this. But he said there was one instance where him and a friend were going upstairs. And on the landing of the stairs, they saw three S-shaped spirits kind of walking in a line. And I don't know what he means by S-shaped spirits. And I couldn't find any other detail about this account. And so I'm like, okay, cool. All I picture is like Schoolhouse Rock and it's an S.
Yes.
And like be bopping in a line like down the stairs. I don't know. And maybe he just means like they weren't a full apparition. It was more like mist or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Apparently, he describes things like I do that make no sense. But complete sense to him, so much so that he didn't elaborate on it at all. He was like, yeah, done. You know what it is.
Yeah, an S-shape. You've seen it.
Another experience that he had was with his wife, Donna.
Yeah.
I'm like, Dan and Donna, how sweet. And they were falling asleep, but there was some like clinking sounds on their nightstand next to their bed. And when they looked over there, it was a bracelet and some earrings that were basically doing a little dance together on the table, but there wasn't any gust of wind or anything. And so Dan really believes that it was like residual energy that was tied to the jewelry. So it wasn't like, oh, the ghost is up doing like, oh, let me inspect this, you know, bracelet real quick. It was more about something that had happened with the jewelry, someone who had owned the jewelry before, that kind of thing. Now, speaking of objects holding residual energy, he like really thought that like more than we think, you know. He said that his friend Michael Jackson, you might have heard about him, he had a cabinet that he bought during a trip to Germany, but it ended up being like his version of the Dybbuk box, and so he got rid of it. Also, Dan is a big believer in aliens, and he has told like everyone who interviews him that he has seen 4 UFOs in his life. Now, I don't think he's ever said that he has seen aliens before, but the crafts is what he's seen. Now, the first UFO sighting happened in Martha's Vineyard when he was in his 30s, and he said that he looked up in the sky. It was super high in the sky, but it was 2 glowing discs, and they were just kind of flying in like some sort of formation. And he's like, look, I know what planes look like. That's what I thought at first. And he's like, but these were completely different. Then there is one time at the farmhouse where he lives, and then another time in a hotel with some friends. And I don't know, I didn't say this, but he's Canadian. And so the farmhouse he lives in is in Canada. And then also this hotel was in Canada. He said that it looked basically like a really long air mattress or like a Macy's balloon float from the Thanksgiving parade. And they saw it hover and then slowly moved and hovered over the river. And now they were on the 23rd floor of the hotel, and they saw the craft that was about 50 feet away from them. So pretty high in the sky. But again, they really didn't hear anything that would make that noise. And it was going slow. There were no lights on it. And so they're like, UFO. Now, then there's one night that Dan woke up in the middle of the night, and he was like, I've got to go. They're calling me. They're here. And his wife, Donna, was like, go back to sleep. It was just because she thought he was sleepwalking or, you know, something, until the rest of the neighborhood had witnessed a large pink floating light in the sky that night. And so it was like something was telling him, like, come outside, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, you're just sleep deprived. And then the next day, all of these reports of the sighting and all of that, it was like, wait, no, like, that makes sense now. But okay, so Dan grew up and, you know, was always open to spirits and stuff like that. But even when he moved to California from Canada, he couldn't escape a haunted house, it seems. Him and his wife, Donna, bought a 2-story house in the Hollywood Hills that has been a home base for a lot of celebrities like Ringo Starr, Natalie Wood, Mama Cass from Mamas and the Papas.
Love her. They all lived in this exact house, you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. And then even Renee Zellweger.
I love Mamas and the Papas and always liked her because she was bigger. So it's like, man, because it was so hard for her back then, especially with Michelle, what's her face, that was in the group too, being so thin and, you know, all the things. And you really need to watch Behind the Music about them. It's very good.
Apparently, because I'm like, I knew only because her name was Mama Cass that it was in the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah, no, love them. Well, that was dramatic, but I do love them. Maybe not love, like I said it.
Carrie, dramatic? Never. Now, if you want to know the address, it's public record, and it is 7708 Woodrow Wilson Drive. So they bought this house in, like, the 1980s. Farmhouse was more, like, what shaped Ghostbusters, but then all of these little nuggets just happened and kept on inspiring him. So Dan realized that some of the former owners had not left. Lots of phantom sounds, like slamming the doors, things you would see out of the corner of your eye, like just out of eyesight. Lots of people would be touched on their shoulder or their back, but when they looked to see who it was, no one was there.
Donna really loves it when you touch her on her shoulder.
Ugh. It's really just strangers like that. Now, meanwhile, when I'm talking to you and I like lean in, I'll touch your arm and be like, oh my God.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I do apologize for that.
You said, I don't apologize for that?
I do apologize.
I thought you were like, yeah, I do that. I don't apologize.
No, like, I do. Because I understand. But it's just, while she's saying that, is one person in particular.
It's a restaurant we go to and it's the manager. It's not like a big secret.
Yeah. Well, and it's not like sexual or anything. It's just, I have a squishy shoulder, apparently.
I really don't think that has anything to do with it. He's touched my... Well, I have a squishy shoulder, too.
Jury's still out on that one. But okay, so the TV sounds would come on when the TV wasn't on. Lights would flicker on and off. Carrie's favorite. Faucets turning on and off by themselves.
Things do find me.
They do. Now, there were several times the piano would be played, but no one was at the piano, which isn't very surprising, thinking about all the musically inclined people who lived there or visited there back in the day.
I mean, just Mama Cass living there, think of how many people musically inclined came through.
Right. And like, she would host like jam sessions and shit all the time in that house. Apparently, even when you're a ghost, you still need to work on your figure because Dan's Stairmaster would continually turn on by itself. And also, I know that Stairmasters are still around and all of that, but it just reminds me so much of the 80s that was like in his house. Like that was the equipment that they had.
Fuck a Stairmaster. Like that shit is so hard.
Oh my gosh. You know that thing where it's like you're perpetually pushing a boulder up a hill and that's like your personal hell. Like you just, it just keeps happening. Mm-hmm. That's me with stadium seating. And so the Stairmaster, don't love it. Like, because, you know, you get to that point where your legs are so heavy and you can't go up another flight.
Right. Like, let's pick the hardest thing in the planet to do, aka stairs, and let's make a piece of exercise equipment out of it.
Right.
I don't care how healthy I've ever been. Stairs have been so freaking hard. Like, even when I was at my peak fitness, running 5Ks, doing spin like 4 times a week, working out sometimes twice a day, like peak fitness I've ever been. And let me run those fucking stairs at work and I am dying.
Oh, yeah. Never been a fan myself. But okay, one night Dan was home alone and he got into the bed. He heard the door open to his bedroom. So he was like, it wasn't locked, but it was closed and it opened. And then suddenly the room had gotten cold and he felt the mattress dip down behind him. He looked, no one was there, but he was like, what the fuck? Like he saw the decompression in the mattress, like something was behind him. And he was like, well, I'm tired. It doesn't seem to hurt me. So I'm going to snuggle up to this bitch and we're going to go to sleep. Now, in an interview, Dan said that he believes it was Mama Cass, which this is why I'm like, ugh. But it is because the spirit did seem bigger.
Fuck off, Dan Aykroyd. I swear to God, when you said he thought it was Mama Cass, I was about to be like, if he fucking said because the bed dipped in more, I'm going to be pissed.
Right. Again, this is what I put, which made me roll my eyes, but I do get it. When I sit on a bed, it's going to slump down more than someone else. But it's just like, of course.
Yeah, but like picking on that is like low-hanging fruit to me.
But I do get it because he's like trying to say, I think it's Mama Cass. Why do you think that? Because like, how would you know it's her? Well, it was a heavier set ghost. But I mean, I do get it. Like it's an adjective. It's a way to describe how he differentiated.
Well, and I was going to say too, like, so ghosts have weights, but people say something happened and it felt like a kid or whatever. So yeah. I guess, but still. Also, though, did she die in that house?
No, she didn't die in that house, but she spent like a good chunk at that house. But like I said, she had a lot of good memories there. That's why they think like she's still there. Now, Dan said that his daughter saw a man and a woman, both with red hair, walking at the end of the hall before. And some of their friends got spooked one time because they saw a huge black mass that seemed to be walking down the hallway and the landing of the stairs. Now, Dan and Donna ended up selling the house shortly after and moving back to the farmhouse in Canada. Now, they rented out the home to Robbie Williams for 3 months because he had just moved out to LA. Do you remember him? He was a singer.
The name sounds familiar, but then I thought you were just saying Robin Williams weird, but it does sound familiar.
Okay, you would know him. There's one song called like Angels or something, and you would know him. But also, I believe, don't quote me on this, but all you DBs who listen, I think Ellen had went out with Robbie Williams.
Wait, that may be why I know it.
Yeah. But he only lived there for 3 months because he said it was too haunted. He said he walked in and he felt like there was some otherworldly presence there. So he was like, hey, I'll respect you if you respect me because I'm scared the fuck out of you. So, like, let's just live in harmony. So nothing bad really happened, but there was always this uneasiness. He said that he had a friend who was staying with him and the guy came out of the bathroom, like he was taking a shower, and he thought it was Robbie talking to him. But when he got out of the shower, no one was there. And Robbie was like, nah, man, I've been in this room the entire time. Like, you were talking to someone who isn't living anymore.
Yeah, it ain't me.
Right. And both of them had goosebumps after they came to that realization. Robbie said that they had the TV on one night and the show had the song California Dreamin' on it. And that was by the Mamas and the Papas, if you are like me and didn't know. And there was a silence and stillness that you could feel happen when that song was on and a bit after it ended. And then Robbie also mentioned that his dog, Sid, started being really scared of the bedroom where he would whimper and have to be coaxed in. And like I said, Robbie only lasted 3 months because he was like, nope, not for me, not for this rent. And he said even moving out of the house was an ordeal because the movers were so scared of this old lady who was sitting in a chair. And, you know, there was really no old lady there. Like, she was in spirit.
Right.
But, like, he was like, even moving out, it is taking a toll on me. Now, when Robbie moved out of the house, Dan and Donna sold the house to Beverly D'Angelo.
Who the fuck is Beverly D'Angelo?
You really don't know? She played Patsy Cline?
Well, she's not Patsy Cline.
You would know her.
She's the mom on National Lampoon's Christmas.
Okay, but I know her as Patsy Cline.
Well, all the National Lampoons, actually. Yes, she was Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yeah, Loretta Lynn, the Coal Miner's Daughter, but she was Patsy Cline in...
Coal Miner's Daughter?
Yeah.
Yeah, but she was in all the National Lampoons. That's what I would know her from.
Can't believe you didn't know that name, though.
I've never seen Coal Miner's Daughter all the way.
Such a good movie. And Tiffany's going to say it, Donna, because I'd be like, God, you are obsessed. And then I watched it one day, and I went down to Tiffany's house, and I was like, so it was on the TV, and it was a really good movie, by the way, and now I'm obsessed.
But she was obsessed, to be fair.
Yes, yeah, she was. But now Loretta Lynn's granddaughter is on American Idol. But okay, sorry, this is such a weird whoom. But I saw a clip of it, and then it said her boyfriend, and his name is Tyler Ward. And I know that means nothing to you, okay? But Tyler Ward was the name of, like, it's this guy, because I saw him and I was like, ooh. But he was big into the YouTube music scene when I was, like, big into YouTube. And so, like, you would know him because he did a lot of those, like, that Buoyance Avenue or whatever that was.
Buoyance Avenue?
Yeah. Yes. Buoyance, what the fuck ever. But, you know, like, they did, like, the slower.
Loved Buoyance Avenue. That was my favorite thing to study to. Well, not study to, write papers to.
But, so, like, he did, like, stuff with them and, like, I mean, he was a big name around different people. And, like, Alex G was a artist that I really loved. And, like, I don't know. I was just like, whoa, I'm old as fuck. He is, too. But, like, I don't know. It was just, like, had forgot completely about him. And then it was, like, I think her name's, like, Emmy Lou or something like that. And it was, like, her boyfriend. I was, like, put some respect on that name, okay? His name's Tyler Ward. Anyway, that's me. All right, so how we got on that from Beverly D'Angelo, I'll never know. But she bought the house. Now, Dan said that it wasn't something that, like, they pointed out to her. But in California, if you believe your house to be haunted, you have to specify that, like, could be haunted. But it was, like, in the lease, you know what I mean? So they weren't, like, and in section 13 on page 8, you know,
yeah,
look at this thing. They're just like, uh-huh, fine print. Like, just write it real small and be okay with it. But it wasn't soon before Beverly believed the house to be haunted. She said that this was when she had just gotten a divorce. And I believe she was with Al Pacino.
That tracks.
And so this was her, like, starting a new chapter as a single mom. And instantly when she walked into this house, she felt warmth and like she was home. So she had bought the house as is because it was a little bit out of her price range, but she knew Dan and Donna a little bit. So she was like, this is what I could do, but, like, I'll take it as is. Like, we'll do whatever we can to get it to this price so I can afford it. And they did. But since it needed to have some reno done and all of that, she, like, started to do that before her and the kids moved in. So she would normally just be over there in the daytime. But one day she was really tired and she's like, I can just spend the night here. It's fine. Like, sleep on the couch, whatever. And so she said she lit the fire. She was just vibing out and just feeling like she was finally where she was meant to be. But all of a sudden she just kind of said aloud, like, man, all I need is something good to drink and some good music. And she got up to go to the fridge to see if she had anything good, but she just had bottles of water. While she was at the fridge in the kitchen, she heard a noise like something clicked on. And she said that there was a CD player that was mounted under the cabinet. And she was like, I had never even noticed that CD player. But the thing I'm picturing is that Tiff's mom used to have like an undermounted mm-hmm. CD player in her kitchen. And I thought it was so freaking cool because they always had like the gadgets and the gizmos. Like,
Tiffany's stepdad is obsessed.
Yes. And so it was like, oh my God, this is before like Bluetooth speakers and right. all of that. Anyway, so it was a click of the CD player opening if you remember, like, this was when it was kind of like a CD-ROM to where, like, you had to hit the button and then the, like, arm would shoot out, mm-hmm. not the kind that you could just put in and it would, like, suck it in or whatever. She saw that the CD had, like, slid out and there was a CD in there. So she was like, I'm going to see what it is. Put it on and some blues music started and she was happy and she was like, my wish has been granted, like, other than, like, not having a thing of wine, but, like, this is awesome. And so she got comfy, like, was feeling right at home and ended up dozing off to sleep, much like I did earlier today. No harm, no foul. But fast forward a couple of months and they finally move in. And Beverly said that there was this one place at the top of the stairs that was a hot spot, which is completely the opposite of what ghosts normally do by creating cold spots, but apparently it's just Carrie as a ghost. Beverly said there was this one time that her friend had went to use a bathroom and he came out and looked like he had seen a ghost, but turns out that he was washing his hands and the light went off. So Beverly was like, oh, it's probably like a fuse or the bulb's blown, like whatever, I'll change it. But when she went to get the bulb and switch it out, it was on and the switch was still on. So she was like, oh, maybe, you know, it's like a weird, it flickered on, off, whatever. But then another friend had went into the bathroom after that and she had the same thing happen to her. It was more than a flicker. It was, no, like the whole light had went out. And so Beverly just again kind of wrote it off because even though her friends were like, that's some ghost shit going on right there, she's like, it's an older house, you know, like it is what it is. Nothing bad's happened, whatever. Now, 10 days later, Beverly was laying in bed and she said that on her mantle in her bedroom, she had some different jewelry and like little trinkets up there. And she heard some kind of like skittering around. And she said that she saw her jewelry basically like flip-flopping and playing musical chairs on the mantle because it was like it was changing positions in front of her eyes. So she called up Donna and was like, do you and Dan have something to tell me? And they were like, yeah, it's haunted. You must have not read the fine print. They didn't say that, but like,
right.
They're like, yeah, it is. They were like, it's nothing bad though. Like it's just got some residual energy. And Beverly was like, okay, it's harmless. It's fine. Like it gives it some charm, you know? But she did keep having activity. You know, she said that she was trying to go to sleep and she was a horrible sleeper because she used to be up late at night singing and like doing all the things before she was Beverly D'Angelo. And so she just kind of lays there like willing herself to go to bed. But all of a sudden she heard music playing. And so she got up because she was like trying to find the source of the music. And no matter where she would go, it just seemed like she couldn't find the source. And finally, she just screamed, please stop. And it was like, they were like, oops, sorry, and just stopped. And she said that she was able to drift off to sleep after that. And she said that that music reminds her of Mama Cass. And like I said, that she would host a lot of musicians in the house back in the day. And Beverly said that, like, if Mama Cass hadn't died so young, that their paths would have probably crossed. And she was like, I think we're just destined to have been in the same house. They were, you know, like, it was destined that she got this house, like, at a time that she needed it. And she happily shares it with Mama Cass's spirit. I told you, it was a wild ride of, like, started from Dan, and then he had this house, and then, like, other celebrities had rented the house and all the things. But I will say, I watched some of his interviews and it's so funny to hear him bring up like stories that I've done, like Betty and Barney Hill with the alien abduction, the Pascagoula alien abduction, like, you know, all of that. And it's like, oh my God, like I've legit covered that. And like, I don't know. It's just like,
okay, you want to hear something weird about Mama Cass?
Yeah, what?
Okay, I just Googled this because I was like, I remember there being something about her death, but I couldn't really remember what. So when she was 32, she died of a heart attack.
And I think it was in a hotel or something, right?
Maybe. Don't okay. know about that.
Okay.
4 years later, the Who's drummer, Keith Moon, died in the same bedroom, and he was 32 years old.
Oh, shit. Oh, maybe it was at her house. I don't know. That is weird. I couldn't find out who Dan was talking about, but he said that there was this one guy who like came from a famous like musical family, and they were over at the house, and he was like, have you met the kids yet? And he's like, what? And he's like, yeah, we used to play with them when we were kids. I mean, like, they're not here technically, but they're still here. And I'm like, oh my God, can you imagine though being like, have you met the kids? Have you met them? Have you played with them? You know, I'm like, what the fuck? But anyway, sorry. So to bring it back to Dan and Ghostbusters, he said that like he really did take it to where he wanted it to be like the first time he had wrote Ghostbusters, it was more like they had these like huge scientific things, kind of like how his grandfather Maurice was trying to build the ghost voice box and all of that. They just had like even more like elaborate things than they ended up having in the like the second, like the final copy of it. But he was doing it kind of as an homage to his past and like his family and his legacy and all of that.
Okay, well, I failed whoever recommended this story for me because I was in the Discord server and I scrolled and I scrolled and I scrolled and I scrolled, got way, way, way up to the top because, you know, the older recommendations deserve to be, you know, whatever. I saw this recommendation. I was like, this looks really good. Let me go into the Google, look something up, come back, and then like I'll, you know, make sure that I want to do it. Then I'll kind of screenshot their information.
I don't know why you don't screenshot it right then.
Well, I will from now on because it disappeared. And let me tell you, I tried the search feature umpteen times. Creep Mom even offered to search it up, and with all of her searching powers, she couldn't find who recommended it. So I'm sorry that I suck, but thank you for your recommendation on the Discord server. But this is the story about Lena Baker. There is a podcast that does this story so freaking well. It's that podcast y'all have heard me talk about before. It's called Sisters Who Kill. There's a book about this, and they really delved into the book. And so I'm not just gonna. It's not fair to them to just like regurgitate what they said on their podcast that they got from their research. So if you want some more details about kind of the day-to-day of this story, they do a really good job of it. So I highly recommend listening to that. So Lena Baker was born in 1900 in a small town of, well, really a community called Cotton Hill. And this is in Georgia. Now picture 1900s, Georgia. Not long after the Civil War had ended, Lena's grandparents were children of slaves. So she was not very far removed from that part of our history. And you, of course, can imagine what things were still like in this time period. Now, her family ended up doing like a lot of farm work. And eventually in her life, Lena did have three kids. But I didn't see anything about the kids as far as like, was she married? Did she? I don't know. But it seemed to be that she was mostly like a single mom, that she would live with her parents some, and they would kind of help take care of her and her kids. When Lena got into her 20s, you know, there's not a lot of options for a young Black woman to make money in the 1920s in Georgia. Well, anywhere, but for sure in the South. She didn't have a lot of options. It's like cleaning, farm work, laundry, all of those things. So she and one of her friends were like, we're going back to the oldest profession there is. And she and her friend essentially opened a brothel. Now, this brothel did well because, well, it's the oldest profession in the world for a reason. But the thing that made it different was that the men who came were not just Black men. They had white men that would come as well. Now, this was a huge deal because that meant that the white men were sleeping with the Black women, even though that we know that people raped their slaves and stuff all the time. But, you know, they're like, oh, this cannot be. You can't mix races like this because people are fucking terrible. So this brothel, for lack of a better word, did pretty well until the sheriff got wind of not just that it was a brothel, but that it was a brothel in which white men were going. So it was like, cool, 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 when it was just, you know, people who are Black or people of color going. But when they found out that white men were going, that's when they had a fucking problem with it.
I honestly feel like they had a problem with it because the white men were paying then.
Well, and it was owned by people of color.
No, that's what, like, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that they wouldn't have had a hard time, white men paying for those services, if it was a white man that owned it.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, the white men are paying for this from people of color. Because just how you said, they'd be like, no, just do it. And so, yeah, I think that's really what really perturbed them. Because I feel like a lot of people look the other way until it's something that, like, they don't agree with. Like, it gets to a point where, like, eh, it's not okay, but they can do it. And then it's like, no.
Right. Well, the other thing, too, is that interracial relationships were illegal in Georgia. So it wasn't just the fact that it was a brothel, and it was a brothel with white and, you know, and people of color having relations. It's like, it's also, it was fucking illegal. Lena and her friend were arrested. They ended up being sentenced to 10 months of hard labor. Now, it should be said that Lena seemed to be an alcoholic. Like, she really drank a lot before and after she went to prison. But after she came back from prison slash her 10 months of just pure hard labor, she was living with her parents and working with her mom washing clothes.
Did she sing Cheer Up Charlie, though?
God, that's the worst song in cinematic history. So while she's working with her mom doing this backbreaking work, she gets a call to come help someone. Now, there was a guy named Ernest B. Knight. Some stuff calls him E.B. Knight. Some stuff calls him Ernest. I think he went by E.B. Knight, so we're going to call him E.B. the rest of the time. E.B. was well-known in town because he owned a mill, so obviously he had lots of money, but he was an asshole. Like, he was an alcoholic, very abusive to people, and he was just known for that. He was also known to, like, carry a gun with him, like, on his chest or something. Very weird. He was just known to be just an asshole. Well, E.B. fell or something and broke his leg, and he needed someone to help take care of him. That's when Lena got the call of, hey, we'll pay you to be basically like a live-in maid, help him around the house, yada, yada, yada. And Lena's like, hell yes, this is good money. It's stable. It's consistent. It's everything that her kids need. So abso-fucking-lutely, I can deal with him being mean. Well, it didn't take long of Lena working for E.B. before the two of them started drinking together. A lot. Because they both are alcoholics. So they're drinking together all the time. And she's there all the time working. And this eventually leads to a sexual relationship. While it seems, air quotes, consensual, we all know that it's like, because at this point she's about 40. And he's like 20 or 30 years old. I think 20 years older than her. So we're talking like 1940s, maybe mid-1940s. This power dynamic, consent is not, doesn't exist. He is her employer. It's the 1940s in Georgia. Like, it, she cannot consent. Let's just call that what it is. Because she's not allowed to turn him down. She works for him. And he's this powerful man in the community, yada, yada, yada. So she's being raped. Let's call it what it is. But I think that she did kind of play the game. Like, I don't think that it was always something that she didn't necessarily enjoy, you know. But when you have that power dynamic, she's unable to consent. Because, again, she can't say no. Word gets out that they're hooking up. And this is bad because, remember, it's illegal. And also, EB's got a reputation to uphold. Insert eye roll. So EB's sons are pissed. They're like, what the fuck are you doing, Dad? Like, you can't have relationships with her. Like, we want her gone. And he's like, fuck y'all. Like, I need somebody to help me around the house. She's not going anywhere. So this goes on for a little while. EB has a son that lives there and a son that lives in Florida. So basically, the sons got fed up with it. And they were like, you're going down to Florida. Like, we're shipping you down there because you can't do this. So EB does move down to Florida. But eventually, Lena makes her way down to Florida too. I don't know how much of this is her own free will, because was he like, hey, you need to come down here? Because they did get drunk together and, you know, so we know that she enjoyed that part of it. So I don't know if he was like, hey, why don't you come down here and I'll pay you to keep working for me? And she's like, I got to feed my three kids. I don't know. I don't know if she was forced. I don't know. But either way, she shows up in Florida and the son's like, the fuck are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. Kicks her out, like, go back to Georgia. EB is like, if she's gone, I'm gone. I'm going. Like, I'm going back home. So he does. He comes back to Georgia, like, following Lena. And it seems like she really is kind of trying to get away from him because he was a mean guy. And I really do think there was some abuse, especially, like, the more they drank and all of that together. Again, she wasn't ever able to tell him no. The town was really small. And so she could never hide from him either. Like, if she's walking home, he's going to see her walking home and be like, hey, come on back over. And she's like, I don't want to. And he's like, get the fuck in here, you know? And again, everybody knew in town, because if she wasn't at his house or the mill and he wanted her, he would go to her house, knock, 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 and be like, I need Lena. And so then she would have to leave with him too. So it was like, people knew. This was the talk of the town, because you can literally see him walking to, because you know they don't live in the same parts of town. So you can literally see him walking over there and then her returning with him.
And also, if they got arrested for this, she'd be the one to be, you know.
Yes, exactly. She'd be the one to get in trouble. They touched on that on The Sisters Who Kill, because they go into more detail about, like, the sons and how much time they actually spent together and, like, how she really kind of couldn't get away from him. And when she would be like, no, like, I have to go, like, I'm going to get in trouble. He's like, I don't give a shit. I'm not going to get in trouble. So stay.
Right.
Yes. It was a very bad situation for Lena. And with no end in sight, like, what was she going to do?
Right. He literally went to Florida and was like, no, I'm coming back.
Well, brought her to him.
Yeah.
And then when the son was like, bitch, you got to go because this is my house. And she left. He followed her.
Yeah.
So one night, EB shows up at Lena's house with her mom. Like, knock, knock, knock. I need to see Lena. She needs to come with me. She's like, no, I can't. You know, got to work in the morning kind of thing. And he's like, no, like, come drink with me. She was like, fine, because she had no choice. Like, he's like, you're coming with me. So she starts to go with him. And some stuff says she escaped at that point. But then on that Sisters Who Kill, they say that she was like, well, give me some money. Let me go buy some alcohol and I'll meet you back at your meal. So she dodged him in that moment. But then, like I said, the next morning when she's like trying to creepy toe back home without him seeing her, she's like, I'll be fine. You know, he ain't gonna know I'm, you know, trying to go home at this point. And so she's like trying to tiptoe kind of back home, and he's sitting outside the mill, like, waiting on her, and is like, bitch, get in here. Like, you thought you could trick me? Like, get your ass in here. And she's like, bruh, like, I gotta go home. Like, I've got, you know, gotta go to work, all the things. And he's like, you're not going anywhere. He used an iron bar to lock the door.
Oh, shit.
So at this point, he's literally keeping her hostage. I mean, he kind of has this whole time, you know, for however long this went on. But this time, literally locked the door. And she's like, please, please, like, let me go. I have to go. And he's like, abso-fucking-lutely not. And she's like, well, you know what? If you're not going to let me go, then I'm just going to fucking go because I have to go. And he's like, if you leave, I will kill you. And so at this point, she's like, fuck. Like, he's serious, you know? You just have to think of the fear that she's grown up with her whole life and a white man being like, if you try to leave, I'm going to kill you. She knows he's going to.
Yeah.
Because she knows people her whole life that have been killed for way fucking less. She's terrified. EB actually has her locked in there. So he's told her at this point, like, if you leave, I'm going to kill you, blah, 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 blah. But like, hold on, I got to go to church. So he literally, the eye roll on Donna's face, if y'all could have seen it. But so he literally leaves her locked in this meal, this hot ass fucking meal, goes to church. She's not had anything to eat or drink all day. There was one thing on that Sisters Who Kill where they said what she did was she actually took his money and went and bought alcohol and like passed out in a field. Mm-hmm. And then like creepy toed back home. But everything else is like she just escaped. But picture if that's really how that shit went down, like she's hungover, hot, hungry, thirsty, tired, and locked in this fucking mill with him gone to fucking church. So EB comes back from church and actually brings her like a leftover plate. I don't want to put words in Lena's mouth, but I feel like at that point she's like, okay, maybe he's going to let me out. Like, let me get this food in. Let's reason with him, you know, whatever. So after she eats, she's like, okay, like I really have to go. And he's like, you're not going anywhere. And he gets his pistol out. And she's like, look, I've got to go. So again, you're just going to have to fucking kill me. And he goes to attack her. So the two of them are struggling with the pistol. They're like in a tussle. And all of a sudden, the gun goes off.
Oh, God, she shot him.
And she doesn't know at first, like, what happened. And then she realizes that EB is on the floor and he's bleeding.
Fuck.
The gun had gone off and the bullet went straight through his head and he died instantly.
Oh, fuck.
So she's like, literally, oh, fuck. Like, what do I do? So she goes home and she tells her mom, like, I fucking just killed him. Like, what do we do? So this is like April 30th, 1944. So Lena and her mom end up going over to the coroner's house because they're like, he's actually kind of decent to people of color. And I think he'll help us. They went over there, like, knock, knock, knock. Hey, he comes to the door and they're like, she's like, I think I killed E.B. Knight. And he's like, the fuck? What do you mean you think you get, you know, like, what? So she tells him what happened. Like, he was holding her in the mill and they got in a scuffle and the gun went off. So he's like, girl, you go straight to the sheriff's office and I'm going to go to the mill and, like, see what's going on. Well, Lena's like, that sounds like a terrible idea because I know what's going to happen to me at the sheriff's office. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go home instead. The coroner goes over, sees what happened, and he, of course, has to tell the sheriff. So the sheriff comes by and picks her up and takes her in and books her. Now, pretty quickly, this goes to trial. The judge was known as Two Gun because he had two pistols with him at the bench at all times.
Oh, Lord.
Right. So this ends up going to trial on August 14th of 1944 because she's like, look, this was self-defense. Like, yes, I killed him, but he was literally holding me captive and would not let me leave, had a fucking gun on me. We fought over it and it went off. But she can't remember, like, who pulled the trigger or, you know, anything like that because it was such a quick scuffle. So she goes to trial. And, of course, she's a, you know, 44-year-old black woman with a jury of 12 white men. And it didn't help that there were rumors of them, I hate that it's, like, romantically involved because it wasn't, but of them having sex, right, a.k.a. essentially her being raped. Which that's what pisses me off so bad because just like you said about she's going to be the one that gets in trouble, not him. She's the one that's looked down on them having a sexual relationship, air quotes, not him. Like, you still see that with sexual relationships. Like, the woman is the one that's supposed to be the virgin, but yet the man cannot be. You know, all those things. It's like, I don't know. It annoys me.
Yeah.
So the trial lasted, how long do you think it lasted?
5 days.
4 hours.
Oh, fuck. And I was like, no, it's got to be real short, 5 days. Holy fuck.
4 fucking hours. Guess how many witnesses were called?
0.
Correct. Because, you know, she didn't have any fucking money. So she has to do a court-appointed attorney. And she was very quickly convicted. Now, she was given the death penalty, and it was to be in the electric chair. Her attorney was like, she didn't really get a fair shot at this. I think she needs another trial. So the governor was like, you know what? Okay. We're going to put her death sentence on hold for 60 days so that we can review this because, you know, the attorney's being like, she needs another trial. But after the review, they denied her clemency. So the execution date was set for March 5th of 1944. So we're talking like literally within a year.
Wow.
She's already got a date. She was kept in the men's prison in a solitary confinement cell, which was right by the execution chamber.
Oh, fuck.
Lena Baker was the only woman to be executed in the state of Georgia by the electric chair.
Oh, shit.
She was later buried in an unmarked grave in Mount Vernon Baptist Church, but then later they gave her a grave marker. That to me too just shows how tight money was for her family.
Yeah.
And the lengths that she would have gone to provide for them.
Yeah.
And the thing is too, is that if that happened now, there would still be some of the same shit as far as like it being a black woman with a white man. But I do feel like now we understand a little bit better self-defense with women when it comes to men, you know, with men and all. But again, I really feel like some of the same issues with this trial would have happened today.
For sure.
Later, looking back, they were like, yeah, they really could have charged her with involuntary manslaughter, which would have not been like with the capital punishment.
Yeah.
But her last words were, what I done, I did in self-defense, or I would have been killed myself. Where I was, I could not overcome it. God has forgiven me. I have nothing against anyone.
Gosh, that's heartbreaking.
But in 2005, so 60 years later, the Georgia Pardon and Parole Board gave her a full and unconditional pardon. And they said that denying her clemency was a, quote, grievous error.
Well, good. I mean, way too late, but good for her memory, her family, and all of that.
So in 2001 is when Georgia stopped using the electric chair.
2001?
Yes. And so she's the only woman. And then there were like 255, I think, or 225, I think it's 255 men who had been put to death in the electric chair. Ugh. But now their old death chamber at this Reidsville prison has been like restored to its original condition. And so it's more of like a museum type thing right then. It's got a document next to it and has a photo of Lena, and it's got like her last words under it. I'm happy for her family that her name was cleared in some way, but damn, too little too late though.
Right. Yeah.
She should have never.
Took them 4 hours to convict her and then like a week to execute her.
Right.
But then took 40 years to clear her name.
It's just so fucked up because she was in a lose-lose situation. She was going to lose her life either way.
Yeah. Just how she said in her last words.
Like, there was literally nothing she could have done because either he was going to kill her or she was going to kill him. Like, there was literally no other way for her to out because, I mean, he's drunk and has her kidnapped.
Yeah. And also, it wasn't just her she was thinking about. Her family, like, it wouldn't just have ended with her.
Right. Exactly. Because, I mean, again, think of the times. And they would burn people's houses down. And they would, you know, they wouldn't just stop with you.
Yeah.
I just don't understand the mindset of, like, how can you hate someone that you let clean your house? Well, force. Clean your house. Raise your kids. Have sex with. Like, how can you be like, I hate people of color, but then I want you in my life in all these ways?
Yeah, I don't know.
But then again, we can't understand it because it's like a power thing. It's a thinking that they're property and less than, which is just disgusting.
Right.
I don't understand that.
Like, it's a good thing that we don't understand.
Right.
That means that we literally have no fucking comprehension of how that could be.
I know. I just can't imagine the fear for everybody, for her mom when she came home, you know, even just go into that coroner's house, you know, and it's like her name is tarnished for her air quotes relationship with EB. His isn't.
No, because she must have done something to him to make him want to have sex with her.
Right.
You know,
well, it was her fault. She was the aggressor. She was the whatever, which is not the case. It can't be the case.
Well, I had never heard of Lena before.
Me neither.
Well, thank you to whoever recommended this.
Whoever you may be out in the Discord universe.
Someone's going to be like, it was on Facebook?
No, I know for a fact it was on Discord. But I did take a couple more screenshots while I was searching again.
Yeah. So you got some good ones lined up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I can't wait. Hopefully y'all can't. And thank y'all so much for listening to this episode.
You stole my words. Don't forget to like, subscribe, review, all the things. And remember,
creep it real
and don't get scared.